When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750. Line up now. Phone lines are open and on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So it was an interesting week in the stock market, right? The kind of week that makes you want to, I don't know, just have a little bit of a headache past the Advil week. We saw the stock market absolutely tumble. Nouriel Roubini, who predicted that we were headed towards a major collapse back in 2007, he was actually even a little bit ahead of that, was at Davos this year, the World Economic Forum, and talking about what was going on, and he described what happened this week in the market as a mini perfect storm. Now, 2007 was sort of a major perfect storm, right? And we saw a whole lot of things tipping into each other. But what's happening this week seems to be, and it's not that this is the week that it happened, it's more that this is the week that people kind of woke up and said, oh, there's a lot going on again. So Nouriel Roubini said, look, there's weak data in China. It's growing at 7.7%. By the way, that's we would kill for that growth. But in China, which everybody expects to have double-digit growth, 7.7% is seen as a major underperformance. Then Argentina devalued its currency after its premier said, I will not devalue the currency. And they've let their currency slide like 15%. And that was seen as completely chaotic. And then you've got the Ukraine, where things are chaotic. And there's tension between China and Japan. And people in Davos started talking about 1914. 1914 was 100 years ago. We're at 2014. That was 1914. So what was 1914? Rising power facing an existing power, which has always led to war. China and Japan are fighting over some islands that most of us will never get to. And it would be nice to say that diplomacy could reign supreme here, but there are some concerns over whether China and Japan are really going to, and they're the second and third biggest economies in the world, which is amazing, right? You have the biggest country in the world and one of the smallest countries in the world, and they're, you know, the number two and number three. So you kind of say to yourself, what's going on here? You know, the Dow was down significantly. Markets across the world were down significantly. I mean, a 300-point drop. I was trying to remember the last time we had a 300-point drop. It was quite a while ago. Quite a while ago. And you have to kind of ask yourself, are we, because people were saying, oh, we're back in 1914, but we might also be instead back in 2007, 2008. And do you remember how ugly that was? I remember sitting around on an advisory board at a meeting for what was then called Consumer Credit Counseling Services of Greater Atlanta, which then became Credibility, which is now ClearPoint. And listening to an economist from the Ford Foundation talk about how we were about to go over a cliff. And it had been, he was able to verbalize everything that I had been feeling, which was a real sense of uneasiness. And I would talk to you about it on the radio on Sundays, and I would hear back from people. Like, I remember this one call particularly, the owner of a Lexus dealership in town who said, Elise, you're crazy. I'm having my best months ever. And I remember thinking to myself, enjoy it, because it isn't going to last. And sure enough, about 2 months later, things started to get pretty scary. So where are we now? I have been waiting for the last couple of years for the other shoe to drop. I never expected back in 2008, when Lehman Brothers went under, that the Fed would step in and start spending $1 trillion a year buying up debt just to keep interest rates artificially low. And the concept behind the buying of all that debt, which, by the way, the Fed is slowing and it seems to be poised to slow again, the whole point was to keep interest rates low so companies would make investments. But that didn't quite happen. And to make banks give out loans, which also sort of happened. So what really happened is an artificial expansion of the stock market. Zooming up. And you have to wonder, now that we've started to see earnings come in and they are well below expectations, it's not like companies aren't making money. They are, but they're not really making money at a rate that I think a lot of people would like to see. And we're certainly, even though we've got unemployment down, we're certainly not making jobs at the rate that we would like to be making jobs. And there are all kinds of structural issues in how we have people earning money at the top and people earning money at the bottom of our economy, and what education is doing or not doing to prepare people for the future. It's interesting. I was in Tucson this week, and I've been traveling every single week since I got back from my vacation, my Christmas break with the family, and I've been traveling for business. The first week I was hanging out in Atlanta, and the second week of the year I was hanging out in New York for a week. And I talked to you about that last Sunday, talking about the real estate technology platforms that I was seeing at Inman Connect and what I thought that meant for how you are going to buy and sell homes. And there was a lot of stuff that just seemed really old, and there are a few things that seem sort of new and modern, and we'll see how they play out as they actually come to market a little bit later on this year. This past week, I was in Tucson, and I was sitting with a guy who has patents on, I don't know how many inventions. He's 36, 37, 35, somewhere in his mid-30s-ish. And so full of passion for what the next 5 to 10 years of the Internet look like. And it was such an interesting conversation, and I was there at the behest of a friend of mine who is everything from a physicist, working physicist, to a concert pianist, all things in between. But what he mostly does is he connects people and technology and companies. And I was sitting and listening to them, he and this guy who started this company, yet another company, talk about technology and how the Internet is going to profoundly change over the next 5 years. And how we can't even imagine, most of us who are out there in our lives working, how fast the Internet is changing. We see how fast things are changing when we see things like this virus, which has whipped through most American households, I would say, have been affected, between Michael Stores, which just announced that its consumers have been the victims of data breach, right? And then you have laptops stolen, right? We saw that this week, the announcement, laptops were stolen, and another 75,000 people there. And then you had the Target breach of 110 million, perhaps. Neiman Marcus, I got my letter this week, that you may have been, you've shopped here in the last year, so you may have been a victim. So pretty much you add just like 6 or 10 stores together that have actually announced, and then you just imagine who's not announcing, because I know there are a few more that are about to announce, and you think to yourself, well, that's pretty much everybody with a credit card. So we think about these viruses and Internet technology and how this is changing. That's how we see it. But what I saw last week when I was in Tucson, right? I see technology that will make Google Glasses seem obsolete in 4 years. Google Glasses, which, you know, is so incredible, the technology that you can wear these glasses and you can see and experience and do the Internet in your eye, which is not such a great thing anyway, right, when you're trying to focus on somebody else, but whatever. And this next generation that's coming after that is almost 10 times as powerful. And how will that shape everything? And how do we stay competitive in a world that is running so fast? It feels like technology is changing the speed of light. And how do we keep our place and educate our kids for that change? And what I'm seeing as I travel around the country, excuse me, is that I was up late last night, you can tell. It's all, you know, caught in my throat today. But what I'm seeing as I travel across the country is school districts earlier and earlier, and I mean grade school, start to introduce computer coding to their kids. That this is becoming a required curriculum. So your kids will have math and language and science and English and history and computer programming. So that this next generation, this millennial generation that my kids are almost too old for, although Michael, my 16-year-old, is going to be doing computer programming all summer, right? But the kids who are 13, who we had a 13-year-old in our house last night, and he's already a computer programming genius, right? Because they can learn this earlier, and these kids are going to be the ones who step into this innovation. And they continue to push it forward, and they're going to be ready at the speed of light because this is what they're going to be learning. All of this is going to have such a profound effect on our workplace productivity, what we do, what we make, and then ultimately how our economy works. And so if you remember what happened in the aftermath of 1914, yeah, we went to war, and it was a horrible war. And millions of people died in a horrible way. And then we started on a path of innovation and not really prosperity, after we needed the end of World War II, but we started on a path of innovation that changed how the world worked. And this, if that's what it means to say we're back at 1914, that we're going to have a period of time that's just really hard, and then out of that is going to be this fabulous innovation that's going to make the world a much better place. That's interesting. I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's interesting. Certainly the pace of change is speeding up. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink. We're going to take your calls. There are a few lines open. Coming back in just a moment on the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 25 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. The number 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online all the time at thinklink.com, thinkglink.com. Somebody sent me an email this week and said, please, please spell your website. So now I have. I'll probably do it later, too. Stan joins us on the line from Snellville. Hi, Stan.
Good morning, Liz.
What's going on?
Just taking it easy right now.
Nice for you.
Very good. I've got a question. I have a substantial amount of money in my 401k, and my income stream right now is such that, fortunately, I don't have to disturb that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering that at my demise, well, being that the 401k contribution was put in before taxes, taxes, I think, probably will be due if I leave that to my beneficiaries as an inheritance. Would that be taxable?
Yes, of course it will. What they'll do is they will roll it into an inherited IRA, right? And then they'll have a period of time that they have to take it out, and they'll pay taxes when they take that money out.
All right. Well, since it's a large sum of money that would be at a federal tax rate of 39.6% and at today's rate, would it be better for me to start making withdrawals on that and maybe putting that into other income generation avenues?
Well, that's a pretty broad question, and you have to wonder how much money is in there.
Probably over $700,000.
That's a great amount of money, but I don't know that you should make that move, because when you take out the money now, you'll also pay taxes at that amount, right?
But my income right now would be that it's at a lower taxable rate.
I'll tell you what. Let's continue the conversation. We'll take a little break, right? News, weather, and traffic. It's the bottom of the hour. You hear the music playing. You want to stick with me, and
sure,
we'll talk about this some more?
Absolutely.
All right. Hang on a sec. Dan is going to stay tuned, and we'll have a longer conversation about this on The Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com at midday every Sunday with Elyse Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750 is our number. There are a couple of lines open. We were talking with Stan before the break. Stan has about $700,000 in a 401k. He doesn't need the money now, and wondering what kind of taxes the money's going to face after he dies and what he should do about that now. So, Stan, when I asked you, I mentioned just before we went to the break that if you started to withdraw this money, you'll pay the tax now. And
yes.
You said that your income was such that it wouldn't be as high.
That's correct.
So your income how much of this money would you plan on taking out to not push yourself into the 39% bracket?
Well, I was thinking about maybe... If the market stays good, I had over a 60% return last year, and in 2013, I was thinking that maybe I have a second home, and I've been working on it, and I was thinking about maybe taking for 2 or 3 years in a row, maybe $100,000 per year, which would put me up at a 28% tax bracket, but it'll keep me right under. Not much, but right under the point where it would throw me into it goes up to, what,
33.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I was thinking, but I'm not cemented there.
Well, so you had a 60% return. The odds of you having another 60% return are pretty low, especially if you look at what happened this week,
right?
So... you have to decide where your money is going to make the most money for you or where it's going to lose the least amount of money for you, right? So sometimes taking money off the table is a good idea. That's why people rebalance their portfolios. So if you say to yourself you had a 60% return, those mutual funds that you're in now probably won't have that kind of a return next year. So you have to decide, can you rebalance? Is there a way to take money off the table? If you want to take $100,000 out and use it somewhere else, that's fine. But the $100,000 will come with a, 28% federal penalty at the minimum, and I think it may be even higher than that. Plus, you have your state tax as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll net $60,000-$65,000, right?
Right.
And you've got to now put that somewhere else. But that's a pretty decent-sized hit for money you don't need. Just because you're worried about what will happen someday, when you die.
But the thing about that, Elyse, is that the total amount of money in that 401k would be hit at a much. If that money is still there, it will be hit as it stands right now, close to 40% at federal tax rates.
Right, which you don't know what will happen to that, and if you leave it to one person, it will happen, but if you leave it to two people, and they each, so instead of it being $700,000, it's now $350,000, they have 5 years to withdraw the money, then they won't be, right? There are things that you just, there are other ways that you have to control the tax flow on this money, other than taking a huge hit today. But if you want to take the hit today, then what you're doing is playing a game that my tax rate, as high as it's going to be now, is still lower than it's going to be 10, 20, 30 years from now. So I'm going to take the money now and do something else with it. And I'm okay with that as a tax strategy as well. I just want you to think through the different options that you have. So let's say you take the money out and you net $60,000 out of your $100,000. So you are paying a net rate of, let's say, 40%. Now what are you going to do with the money?
Well, I don't know. Reinvest it. If what I don't use, maybe reinvest it, perhaps even open up a Roth or something like that.
Okay. So to open up a Roth, you have to have earned income.
Oh, okay. That's not going to work. I'm retired.
Okay. So you can't do that. What else?
Well, I was just thinking that that money could sit in the bank if I pay a 28% tax rate versus my heirs paying a 40. That's just federal, not including states, you know.
So this is something I would recommend against, because if you pay, it's likely that keeping your money invested in the stock market will produce returns. Maybe not this year. Maybe it'll take another 5 years or 10 years. But you could expect that the money will grow at, let's say, between 8 and 10% a year over a period of time, 10 or 15, 20 years. And so if it grows at that rate, let's say it grows at 7%, and in 10 years it doubles, and now you've got $1.4 million in there. Versus you take your $60,000 out and you put it in a bank account where it's earning nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Which in the long run, and I'm just asking the question, right? I mean, I could do the numbers for you. I don't have the computer screen up right now in front of me that I could do it for you. But you can do this number. You can go to any of the big investment funds and just play this game, or CNNmoney.com. You know, what's the better investment? To double it and then pay more tax, but versus taking a big tax hit now and then having no growth.
I see. And, well, it's paying me a good, it's invested in a dividend-paying stock, and it's paying me a very nice dividend income that helps me not need to tap into it.
So that's actually a good thing, then.
Yes, it's very good.
So there's a bigger strategy here, and I would recommend for you, Stan, because it is such a significant amount of money, and you obviously have other resources coming in as well. So good for you all the way around. And good for being thoughtful about this and helping everybody else listening at home think about what they're doing.
Well, that's been a big help to me, Lisa. I appreciate it, and enjoy your show. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. And I was going to also say, and I think this is an important point for everybody who finds themselves in a situation with a lot of money and no really good ideas about what to do with it. The best thing to do is to have some conversations with outside investment professionals. Don't necessarily give them your money, but pay for the time and listen. And what you want to do is get a number of different opinions about what you could do that would either minimize taxes, if that's your goal, or it would increase growth, if that's your goal, or it would bring home more income, if that's your goal. And ask those questions to three or four different people at three or four different investment companies and listen to what they say. Because somewhere in between all of those will be the answer that makes the most sense to you and will help you divine the right path forward for you and your money. 404-872-0750. Joe joins us on the line. Hey, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Elise.
Morning.
And I wanted to ask you, I called in a couple years ago, and I wanted to ask you what the status was of the shadow inventory of real estate loans, I guess is what it would be under. From what I've gathered, a lot of them have been packaged off to the hedge funds on Wall Street, and they're renting the properties presently. But I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on the future of what those hedge funds may do and the effect that it may have on the real estate recovery that we're in.
You know, I'm glad you asked this question, because last week or the week before last, when I was in New York, I was hearing a real estate agent, talk about this new phenomenon, right? This was one of those things that sounded really cool and new, but it's actually like several years old. And they were calling it BTR. And BTR means buy to rent. And it's the strategy that Goldman Sachs says is going to be up like $100 billion a year strategy for the next few years. And this, to your point, is what's eating up or sucking up all of the, you know, excess housing. And what we've seen is, in fact, and I had a conversation with a guy named Rick Sharga, who's been a guest on the show before, and he used to be with a company called RealtyTrack, which does a lot of data processing.
Yep.
And now he's actually with auction.com. And I want to have him back on the show to talk about this, because he's such a keen observer about what's going on. But he was saying that he actually thinks in about two and a half more years, all of the excess inventory, the shadow inventory, will be completely absorbed into the marketplace. And it has taken, I mean, this is 2014. I mean, you'll remember back, if you're a longtime listener to the show, that in 2007 and 2008, I was saying, you know, it could be 15 or 16 before this is all wiped up. And some people were saying 2017. And that just seemed so far away. Well, it's here now. And Rick was confirming that, sure enough, this stuff is actually all getting sucked up. And he thought it was going to be one of the 2017, 2018 till it got, you know, sucked up. But what really is happening is that the hedge funds have been so much more active in, because the interest rates have been so much lower. So the hedge funds are turning around and renting these properties back to the homeowners who were living in them and then defaulted on them in many cases. And their strategy is to kind of hold on to them. Now, the interesting point is, what do they do when they start to, when they decide, because hedge funds live on like a five-year cycle where, they, you know, they're not content with 7% a year. Their whole strategy is, you know, 20 to 40% per year growth. So you don't really get that with the housing market. And the only way to get that is to sell. And it's one thing to buy from FHA 1,000 houses at a time. Really hard to unload 1,000 houses at a time. So I think that hedge funds are in for a little bit of a rude awakening. And when they start to try and unload these properties, unless what they're going to do is just offer mortgages to the people who are living there at a more advantageous price, and they're going to do that in mass, and that could happen. But otherwise, if they start putting these houses on the market, I think we're going to see a deflationary period again where housing prices are just not going to, either not going to move or they're going to fall. And where we're going to see most of that are places that have been hit already, like Las Vegas, the state of Michigan, Illinois, Georgia, California, those markets that had that huge increase in property price, and then that got absorbed. And I think there will be an opportunity then again for regular investors like me who decide they want to pick up a house or two or five to be able to go and find good properties. So the good news is that I don't see large tracts of houses in most neighborhoods. There are some pocket neighborhoods which are still awful. But those are neighborhoods that were always awful. And those will, you know, take other kinds of changes to be able to improve and bring them back. But like in Detroit, they're now bulldozing streets. I mean, that's the kind of change when I say we're going to need some structural changes. It's like they're just going block by block now, and they're destroying houses that are abandoned and derelict and causing other kinds of problems. They just don't have the city resources. Like if one of them catches on fire, you know, there may not be fire people who, you know, fire people who can go there and solve that problem. So, but overall, I think what we've seen is that the market has absorbed those shadow inventory homes to a large extent and at a faster clip, and now they're just going to be there renting them for a little while. That help?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's simple supply and demand, and I can see that most of these hedge funds got these properties pretty for a cheap price through the, what I've heard is the FDIC loss reserve insurance program, and therefore they can, they're in on the deal so low that they can finance them back once the prices start getting higher and interest rates get higher. That's, well, the other thing that I've uncovered.
Well, they can only do that if indeed there are people willing to buy them and can afford them. And so now you get to the other thing that I keep talking about, which is jobs are really tied to real estate. And I've said it since, you know, like, I don't know, all 2000s. Jobs and real estate. If you don't have a job that pays the mortgage, even a low interest rate mortgage, even a lower price mortgage because the property value has fallen by a third, if you can't afford that, you're not going to be able to buy that house. And so we still have three people unemployed for every job available in this country. And the people who have gotten jobs in many cases are making less than they were making before. And so we really have not fixed the unemployment problem that we had back in after the 2000 recession, which was a jobless recession, called a jobless recession, and we still have elevated unemployment. And those problems will have a longer-term impact on real estate, I think, in many areas than the shadow inventory. But I appreciate your question, Joe, and your thoughtful answer. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elyse Klink. Stay tuned. We'll answer more of your questions next on The Elyse Klink Show, News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find Elyse Klink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
56 minutes past the hour on The Elyse Klink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Lori joins me on the line from Acworth. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good morning, Elise. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I have inherited some less than desirable rental properties.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm upside down on both of them. One of them is currently rented, so it's kind of being maintained, if you will. But I keep getting these postcard solicitations in the mail that someone wants to buy your property at, you know, such and such address. And I was just wondering how, if you were familiar with that and how legit they are.
Well, let me ask you a question, Lori. When did you inherit these?
I inherited them 4 years ago.
Ah. So one of the things that you could have done...
Oh, no. My call's late, huh?
About 4 years late. When you inherit property that you don't want, you don't have to accept it.
Oh, my.
So... maybe there's some reason you needed to accept it, but, you know, if you had spoken with an estate attorney, they may have said to you, you know, you can just say, I don't want this. Just because somebody wants to leave it to you doesn't mean you have to take it.
Oh, I'm sorry for the interruption. It was my my husband, and the properties were in my name as well.
Okay, so...
does that make a difference?
It does, because you already own them.
Okay.
You just got the other half of them. So, all right. So you're in a little bit. But just in general, just good thing to keep in mind that you don't have to take it. So what do you do now? You know, these properties that you're getting the cards about, they may or may not be legitimate, but there are ways for you to unload these properties if you want to get rid of them. And one way, if they're underwater, well, first, if they're underwater, you should see if you can try to refinance them under HARP. And you can go to HARP.gov, H-A-R-P.gov, and see if you qualify for refinancing under the government program. And if you do, that may help get them at least positive, cash positive. You may want to try and auction these properties. You may also want to just give them back to the landlord, to the lender and do a deed in lieu. Just to get rid of them. But there will be tax consequences either way. So we should explore this a little bit more, which we'll do if you hang on. I'll come back to you after the news, weather, and traffic, and we'll talk a little bit more about what you might want to do on News Talk WSB.
When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
12:06 on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB, the number 404-872-0750. Follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, or go to the website thinkglink.com. So we were talking with Lori, who owns two rental properties, and both are underwater. She's got... getting solicitations from just random postcards inquiring about buying the properties, and there's a whole host of problems. So before we went to break, Lori, we were talking about whether you're eligible for HARP. Do you know, have you looked into the HARP program?
I have been, yes, I've been contacted by my lender regarding refinancing my properties. I've not done so yet. My... I had planned on it, but my goal would be to get rid of the properties.
I totally get that. I mean, just getting rid of them would be really important. But here's the problem. You could be facing a huge tax liability if you do that.
Okay.
So the first thing is, you said they're underwater. How much, what are they worth, do you think, and what do you owe?
The property right now is probably worth about $65,000, and the mortgage on it is $90,000.
Wow. For each of them or just one?
It's probably about the same for both of them, I would suggest.
Okay. So you're looking at a loss of roughly $60,000, $70,000 between the two?
Yes, ma'am. And with that loss, I would have to take the money out of my 401k to make up that, that loss if they were to sell.
Okay. So, first of all, do you have the money in your 401k? Because then you have to pay tax on that money as well.
Yes, ma'am. I do have the money in my 401k, and that was a rollover. I understand the tax implications on that, but this particular rollover from a different company is not included in my retirement calculation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I felt a little bit more comfortable about that. And I know it's not free money. Again, I know there's huge tax implications, but for a variety of reasons, I really feel like I want to dump those properties.
Okay. Well, I totally understand that. So you could dump the properties. You could maybe refinance them, and then they would be cash positive. But if you just want to get rid of them and you have the money and you're willing to pay the taxes on the money, that's fine. You can also see if your lender will do a deed in lieu of foreclosure and get rid of them that way.
And I'm not familiar with that. You said that before the break, a deed in lieu, give it back to the
right
lender. I'm not sure how that works.
Well, basically, you would contact the lender, or you would have an attorney do it, because the lenders have not been so good about doing this. And in your mortgage agreement, if you read it, what the deal is with the lender is you will, you know, you're borrowing the money, and if you fail to make the payments, the lender has the right to foreclose. Well, and a lot of times, the lender will just agree to take the property back instead of going through the pain and expense of a foreclosure. It's painful and expensive for them as well as for you. So you get the hit on your credit, but it's a better hit than a foreclosure. So you may be able to do that. Now, the other side of it is you will still owe whatever depreciation and taxes, the tax recapture that you would owe. You also would owe something to the IRS, because now the lender will have given you a gift of $60,000, which goes as phantom income, right? You didn't actually earn the money, but the IRS treats it as income on your taxes. If you pay off the lender, then you won't have that hit, but you will take a bigger hit in terms of paying it down, the $60,000 plus the taxes on the $60,000, if you have to, if it isn't just money that's sitting in cash. So the thing for you to do, because this is pretty complicated, and there will be significant implications all the way around, whether tax or just cash, sit down with either your tax planner, like whoever helps you prepare your taxes, or an accountant, and go through the various scenarios, because you want to make sure that you're prepared any way that you decide to do it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Now, years ago, I had gone to an attorney because an acquaintance or a friend, I should say, was telling me just to foreclose on them, and because of some of the investments I have and worth, I guess you could say, the attorney advised me against doing a foreclosure, because they said, with the amount of money that you have, you know, a lot of times if you don't have any money, the lenders won't go after you for anything, but you do. And so they were more than likely to go after, you know, recuperating this loss.
Right. And that's a very good, that's good advice. And in general, that is absolutely true. If you have assets, they expect you to, you know, step up. But it depends where those assets are held. And it also depends on if they're willing, what they're willing to do. But you would definitely need a real estate attorney to negotiate on behalf for you. But if you're willing to just get rid of them, your initial question to me was, are these people who are sending me postcards legitimate? My answer to you is, Lori, if you're ready to let the properties go and you have the money to pay them off, I would contact an auction company and talk to local real estate agents, because there are a whole lot of investors who are looking to buy property, and maybe the people with the postcards are part of it, but as we were saying earlier for the show, there are hedge funds, there are investors all over the place that are looking to make investments at advantageous prices. An auction will coalesce the interest all at one point, and you should end up getting as good a price or more. In fact, there are new numbers coming out that will show that auctions will get you a better price than even just listing the property for investment property, something like 65% of the time. So I would look into online auctions or just a general auction as well as a real estate agent option and see if there's something there that may be able to help you at least get the very most amount that you can, which will, of course, limit your financial liability on the other side. Let me know how it goes, okay? 404-872-0750. It is 13 minutes past the hour. Pat joins us on the line. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question about my stocks. I'm 72 years old, and I just retired last year after 50 years of nursing.
Wow.
And I have money in my IRAs. I have a 401 and a 403. And I want to know if I should pull that money out of the stock market since it looks like it's going down.
Well, it's going down this week. It went up. I mean, we heard from, was it Joe or Stan, I think, the first call of the show today. He said he had a 60% increase last year. So we're never going to see stock prices continue to rise. But what we saw since 2008 when the stock market kind of crashed is that it came right back. So the question for you is, what's your timeline?
Well, being 72 years old, I hope to live another 20 years anyway.
All right, so you've got 20 years to go.
Okay.
Are you a day trader, Pat?
No.
Okay. So day traders are like, this week the stock market didn't look so good, or today the stock market didn't look so good, I'm going to make a change. But for the rest of us, and I put myself right into this bucket, we're in it for the long run. So I would only say to you to sell if you think that over the next 5 to 7 years you see the stock market going down and the economy of the world going down and that things aren't looking right to you. And then I wouldn't even say to sell all. I would say you could take a little bit off the table. But the truth is if you have a 20-year horizon, I don't believe there has been a 20-year period since the 1870s. Where you haven't seen the stock market at least stay even, if not increase.
Mm-hmm. All righty then. Thank you.
You're very welcome. You hang in there, Pat. It's the hardest thing in the world to do, but it's really the smartest thing to do. It's to just hang tight and keep your money in a well-diversified portfolio and not mess around with it too much. 404-872-0750. Karen joins me on the line. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm 57 years old, and I have just had a job change where I'm making half amount of money. I have about $120,000 in an a 401k, and I have a house payment of the entire amount that I owe on the house is $100,000. And with the change in job, that half salary that I have now, it's certainly harder to pay the bills. I'd love to pay the house off. I know there's a lot of penalties in changing the 401k or eliminating the money from it. Just want to know what you think would be the best way to go.
I would hate to see you liquidate your 401k in order to pay off the mortgage. So I would say the question is, number one, is there any other way to earn more income on the side? Can you tutor if you were in the education field, could you do some tutoring? Like my sister-in-law is the head of the Spanish department at a school in Texas, and she tutors on the side. And she does about 20 hours of tutoring a week, and she makes a real lot of money doing that. So is there a way to increase your income somehow? I'm asking questions. I'm not actually coming up with answers at the moment.
Sure.
I want you to think about some of these things. So that would be the first thing. Second thing is there another way to skin the cat, right? So if you can't increase your income, do you have to liquidate everything to pay off that bill? Well, I think not. I would rather see you take a smaller amount out to help pay the bills over the next couple of years while you figure out how to increase your income, or maybe you look for a different job, or something else comes into your life, or you decide to sell your house and live in something less expensive. But you haven't paid all that tax up front, and you still have options. You know, you're still helping yourself pay the bills, right? But you're not actually taking that big tax hit, which may ultimately be unnecessary. And plus, someday you're going to want to retire, and you're going to want some of that cash. So I think that I would rather see you take a little bit of a step back and try to buy yourself some time while you figure out what your next few years of income growth looks like. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes, that makes sense. I was deciding between the two, either increasing the income or going ahead and taking the 401k. So I appreciate your help.
Yeah, I would never advise you to take such a huge hit on all of your cash just to pay off a bill like your house payment, when you could buy yourself a couple of years with maybe $5,000 or $10,000 a year extra out of that account. So you minimize the taxes that you're paying, buying yourself some time and figuring out what's going to make sense going forward. And by the way, 57, you got a lot of years to go, right? Pat just called in. She's 72. You could have 35 more years or more, and I want to make sure that you've got enough income for that. 404-872-0750 on the Elyse Kling Show. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 24 minutes past the hour on the Elyse Kling Show. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Roxanne joins me on the line from Marietta. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi.
How are you?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind today?
I own several properties. Two of them are rental properties, one in Chicago and one in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And then I own a home currently in Marietta. I wanted to know how I could best protect the property from liabilities. I wanted to do a limited liability. But I was told by my lawyer that that's not going to work. I'd have to do a limited liability in each state.
Right. So you're getting good advice from your lawyer, but really, first of all, I would never recommend that you put each property into a limited liability company. One, you may be violating the terms of your mortgage, which would be awful. And the second thing is, there's a better, easier way probably to do this. Have you looked into umbrella liability coverage?
I have. I do have that currently with my insurance company.
And how much do you have it for each house?
I believe I have a total of $1 million to cover all three properties.
So that's probably not enough. It's not an expensive coverage, but I would think you might want to have something more like $4 or $5 million, because you've got three properties and because they're out of state and you're not there. So I would think about maybe increasing that, maybe even take $1 million for each house. And that should give you much more comfort. Because if something happens, you will have a significantly larger amount of coverage.
So do I do $1 million on each? Because in every state I have to have a separate insurance policy. Do I do $1 million on each policy for umbrella, or do I do it on my main property, which I currently own right now and have umbrella on the main property?
So I would talk to your insurance agent about that. Because is it the same company insuring all three properties?
Yes.
So I would talk to your agent and say, give me some options. Always go into the situation where they're going to provide to you, right? So what do you think, I would say to him, what do you think is my best option here? Here's my concern. Here's my problem. Help me solve it. And then see what the agent has to say about that. Because one solution is you increase the coverage on your main property. The other is, if you have separate policies on each of them, you may not be as adequately insured as you think, right? And so the policies that you have for each of the other houses would be renter policies, renter homeowner policies, not homeowner policies. And so you may need a slightly different kind of umbrella coverage for the two rental properties. So I would ask the agent to solve the problem for you, and then if you want to shop around on price, you know exactly what to be asking for.
Okay.
All right?
Great. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You know, that little tip about liability insurance, I talk a lot about that in my Intentional Investor series, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. There are a lot easier solutions than going and starting limited liability corporations for each rental property you own. There are other ways to protect yourself. If you're interested in that, you can find out more about the Intentional Investor Series at thinkglinkstore.com. Thinkglinkstore.com. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Glink. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. I will be back in just a moment with more on News Talk WSB. 1236 on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Don't miss out on the Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate. I'm just getting from all the calls today that my latest work, which is half video and half ebook, is probably going to be pretty helpful. You can actually buy the whole thing together, or you can buy the ebook, or you can buy the videos. And if you use the code WSB, you'll get a 25% discount on anything you buy. Go to thinkglinkstore.com for details. All right, let's go back to the phones. As usual, in the last half hour of the show, we got a whole lot of calls to get through. Dorothy joins me on the line. Hey, Dorothy, how can I help today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a property in Macon, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposed to go into the inventory of foreclosure when the bank, when the Obamacare or Obama program bailed out the bank. And I did a title search on it, and they're saying that the property is mine. The lawyers that were supposed to foreclose on the property said the bank dropped the ball. I have fed this property, and I'm at my wit's end and don't know what to do at this point.
So you need to have a real banks. Okay, let me just start by saying banks were atrocious in not completing the foreclosures they said they were going to complete, and it's probably been years since this property was going into foreclosure. And this means that you don't have a clean slate here, and so you need to get a real estate attorney to get the bank to complete this. The problem is, if this was a primary residence at the time, and you would have been eligible for tax help, that may have expired, and so you really need to get a real estate attorney involved to pressure the bank to finish this foreclosure. Now, if you, on the other hand, if you still own the property and now that neighborhood's come back and you want to reclaim ownership, I guess since it's never been foreclosed on, you still own it, you might be able to do something with it. But again, a real estate attorney is going to be able to kind of parse this out and help you figure out exactly what to do at this point. 404-872-0750. Sean joins me on the line from Lilburn. Sean?
Good afternoon.
Hey, what's on your mind?
Hold on just a second. Yeah, I got a real simple question for you. Came into a bunch of money, decided to invest in real estate, and I bought a couple of properties outright, no mortgage, mm-hmm. and then I paid off my own mortgage, and after I did that, I got to thinking, was that a, you know, was that a smart idea? Hanging on to the tax advantage, you know, leveraging the tax advantage versus no tax advantage, but I'm not paying every month.
All right, so let's break this down just a little bit. You had all this money, and it was sitting what, in a savings account?
No, actually, within a couple of weeks after we got it, we bought several properties.
Okay, let me ask you the other way. What would you have done with the money if you hadn't bought the properties?
Invested.
Okay. So you would have invested the money. You invested it in properties, right?
Right. Right.
What was the interest rate of your mortgage when you paid it off?
About 4.
4%. So yes. You earned 4% on the money that you used to pay off your mortgage.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay. If you'd left it in the bank, you would have earned 0. If you had invested it in the right mix of stocks, you might have gotten 60% on your money. So those are your investment options, right? I'm being a little facetious here, but
no, that's fine.
There's an opportunity cost to everything. So you paid down your mortgage or paid it off, 4%, you got that as a net return. I would never advise you to take a mortgage because you think you're going to get a tax benefit on it, because for most people, that disappears when you start earning real money. And the net effect on a 4% loan, right, and you get a tax benefit, you might actually be netting like a 1.5% or 1.75% tax benefit. It's hardly worth the effort. It's not like when you were at 8% and you were getting a net 6% benefit.
Right.
So
you reaffirmed my decision point.
Yeah, I mean, you invested the money, and frankly, think about it this way, right? Some of it went into, you invested a lot of this money in real estate, right? You bought property and you paid off your mortgage. But there was a divestiture, right? Because you had, you diversified the investment. Some went to a mortgage payoff. Some of it went to investing in property. So you actually, in terms of a global real estate investment, you diversified that investment. And some you took a 4% return, and some you're hoping to get a much greater return. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Have a great Sunday. 404-872-0750. Maggie joins me on the line. Hi, Maggie.
Hi.
What's going on?
Well, I have sold my house, and I will be receiving the funds in a couple of months. And I got out of a nasty divorce in which there are several credit cards that are very past due over 90 days. And I want to use the money that I'm getting from the sale of the home to pay off the debt. And my credit has been just destroyed since this whole thing started, and I really want to repair it and get it back on track. And my question is, should I just pay off the credit cards in full, or should I negotiate with the creditors and try to pay a smaller amount and have them just close out the card?
So if you have the cash to pay it off, you want to pay it off. How much money are we talking about?
It's only about $8,000.
Yeah.
It needs to be paid off. I'm getting about $20,000.
Okay. You should take the $20,000 and you should take $8,000 of it and you should pay it off. And let me explain to you why, so you never feel bad about this. If you try and negotiate with the banks, your credit's already destroyed. So if you pay as agreed, right, your credit is going to start to come back. And you're going to pay it off in full, which is great, which means you probably can keep the cards all together. If you try to negotiate with them, you have to wait another month or two, right, which is more destruction to your credit history and
right.
your credit score. And then your account is never going to read paid as agreed, right? You're going to now have a $4,000 deficiency in which they will now either sell the debt so that you're going to have debt collectors coming after you, or let's say they forgive it and now you're going to go to next year, you're going to pay your taxes and now you're going to get a 1099 from them, which basically looks like income. And so you're going to have to pay tax on the $4,000 that they forgave. So
right.
now you'll have taken an extra big hit on your credit for maybe $3,000, $2,500 to $3,000. It's so not worth it.
Okay.
So just take the $8,000 and pay it off and ask them to pay as agreed. Say you're really sorry, you were in a bad divorce and you're trying to make good and you want to move on. And I'm sure they'll be very happy to take your money. Right? And you're going to pay it off in full, and you're just going to move on. And really, what I love is that you're going to have a fresh start from this horrible divorce, and I'm so glad you're out of a situation that you describe as being horrible. So you're going to move on from that. You're going to move on from your debts, and you're going to have this whole new fresh start, and I just love that for you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You just hang in there. It's all in a year from now, you're going to call me back and say, wow, it's been a great year of growth. I just feel like, Maggie, for you, getting rid of this debt, putting it aside, taking this money. I know you think to yourself, wow, that's so much of that $20,000. There are a lot better things I could do with it. But I promise you, the very, very best thing that you can do with this money is to pay off this debt and give yourself a fresh start financially as you move on from this divorce emotionally. Trust me, it absolutely is going to work out for you. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Jesse, what's going on with you today? Jesse?
Oh, yes, hi.
Hi, what's going on with you today?
I would like to know if there are any options available to me for decreasing an 8.75 interest rate on a mortgage loan.
So tell me a little bit about the mortgage. Is it owned by Fannie and Freddie?
No, it's with Citibank. It's not my primary home. It's for a rental property in Texas, and I owe about $20,000 on it. And I contacted Citibank to ask them if they would work with me to lower the interest rate as well as remove the PMI, but they would not work with me.
So is the property underwater?
Yes, it is.
All right. So there's a couple of things. Have you checked to see if the if the mortgage is actually owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
No, I haven't done that.
Okay. Here's what I want you to do. It sounds to me like you're driving on a car, right?
I am.
Okay. When you get to a computer,
okay,
and not while you're driving on your phone.
Right, I will.
Okay. I want you to go to HARP.gov, HARP.gov. I want you to go to HARP.gov, and I want you to look up, it says, are you eligible? And I want you to look up, and I'm going to put you on hold because there's just a lot of noise around this. So I want you to look up whether your loan is owned by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, and there's a loan lookup tool for both of them, or you can call 1-800-7-FANNIE or 1-800-FREDDIE. And you can call and find out. If the loan is owned by them, there may be help on it, right? As long as you're current on the loan, the loan is for a primary or, in your case, a second home or an investment property. It's an investment property. And it was acquired by Fannie or Freddie before May 31st of 2009. And your loan-to-value ratio is greater than 80%, which it is because it's underwater. So you're going to go look it up. If the loan is owned by them, then you should be able to get help. And if Citibank won't help you, you can just file a complaint against them because they are regulated by the OCC. But they should. Now, the other issue is that you only owe $20,000. So let's say you don't qualify for HARP, the Home Affordable Refinance Program. Then what I think you ought to do is look to see if your employer and your 401k has a borrowing program. If you can borrow $20,000 from your 401k, you can pay off that loan and then pay yourself back. It's not so much money that you couldn't pay it back in 5 years if you try super hard and you use the proceeds from the investment company. If you do that and you take out a loan basically from yourself, at least you're getting rid of the 8.75% interest, and you're able to then pay yourself back the money. And that would be my second suggestion for you. And then the third suggestion is you borrow from whoever you can in your life the $20,000 at a rate that's 4% as opposed to 8.75%, and then use the proceeds to pay it back. So those are your three options. Look at HARP.gov, try to borrow from your own 401k program, and then pay it off that way, or borrow from friends and family, because when you're underwater and it's only $20,000, you're not going to have any other kinds of loan opportunities outside of these. 404-872-0750. It's 48 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Glink, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. I'll be back in a moment to answer a few more questions on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions, only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
It's 12:55 on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. I think we have time for another call. Robert joins me on the line from Suwannee. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. This is a situation. Me and my wife's 46, I'm 49. We've been contributing to her 401k. Got about $320,000, $340,000.
Nice.
We just went through structured bankruptcy where we paid the entire amount of what we owed back. We have an extra $1,500 a month. But we're upside down on our mortgage because we didn't wrap that into the bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Should we start another 401k for me with the $1,500, or should we use it to pay the house down?
How much underwater are you?
We owe $135,000, and we still owe, we owe $135,000, and it's worth about $120,000 on the market.
So here's the thing. if you guys have a significant amount in the 401k right now,
mm-hmm.
and at $1,500 a month, that's $18,000. That'll take you to parity, like within a year.
Okay.
And I think that it'll be even more than parity because the house will probably rise in value some more this year and over
right.
the next 12 months, and you'll significantly pay down this loan.
We lost $40,000 with the crash in 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah, we lost about $40,000 equity. So.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of slowly, you know, starting to come back. For most some people, it's coming back pretty fast, and some people, it's been slow. But for you, this idea of taking, you know, $18,000 in the first year and just paying that down, and I assume that you have a little bit of cash on top of that. So if you don't have cash,
yeah.
like for emergency savings, then put some aside for that, too. But if you could just get it to parity, I think you're going to feel a whole lot better, and then you'll slowly start to build equity, and then you may have some more options down the line. But not being underwater is going to make you feel a whole lot better.
Yeah. Okay. And I just wonder, should we start another 401k for myself?
Well, are you working now? Does your employer
yeah,
offer?
I'm working, but the employee doesn't really have a real good 401k plan.
My
wife's company has a better plan, so we're using, you know, her money to invest as much as we can in her 401k and using my salary to pay the bills.
Okay, well, I like both of those ideas. If you're looking for another place to save, I'd love it if both of you started. You're both eligible, perhaps, given how much money you make, for a Roth IRA.
Okay.
And I'd like you to start saving in a Roth IRA because I think it'll give you some other kinds of savings opportunities down the line. It's after-tax money, not
right.
pre-tax money. So sometimes it's nice to have post-tax money that's saved in a retirement account. And it still gives you all those same protections that a 401k would give you, right? And you get to decide where to invest it. So I like all of that for you. So if you're looking for something extra, you can open up a Roth IRA and you can put away, I think it's $6,000 this year, $5,000 or $6,000, and she can open up a Roth IRA, and that would be a good place to save another bunch of money. So try that and see how it works. All right, the music is playing, and that means our time is up. So happy to be able to help so many people. In the meantime, I'll be back next week, but check out thinklink.com, thinklink.com. Be sure to look at thinklinkstore.com, right? That's our store where we sell all of our products and things like that. You may want to use the WSB discount of 25% on anything in the store. Just type WSB into the code. I hope you have a great week. I'll see you on Twitter in the meantime, and be good out there.